when you're done, President.
Sure.
And basically, maybe his son has his correspondence, and that correspondence will now be a tshuva, and because time's running out. So who was Rav Henkin, okay? Rav Henkin was an Eastern European rabbi born in White Russia, obviously a great Talmudic genius. When he was 17 years old, he wanted to be interviewed at the yeshiva. He knew the whole Gemara Erevin by heart, which is one of the hardest masechtas of Gemara to know. Obviously a brilliant Talmudist. He studied mainly Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was the father-in-law of Aaron Cutler, but a lot more moderate than Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer definitely floated more in the moderate Lithuanian, maybe even somewhat religious Zionist camp. And he lived in Europe. He was there. He was a rabbi for a little bit in Georgia with Svartim. You know, it was interesting, Rav Henkin. And then in 1925, and this is what's relevant to us, he came to America. Now, when he came to America, it was the Wild West of Judaism. I mean, there wasn't any established religious authority. It was crazy, chaotic. So he was like the first really big rabbi post-Sikh. There was Rav Yaakov Yitzchak, who was the chief rabbi in New York, which is a fascinating story in of itself to read about. It didn't go well. He was very, if you ever read about it, it didn't work out well. He ended up leaving because he took on these corrupt butchers and they didn't like it, and he ended up going to Israel. But Rav Henkin was probably the first world-class post-Sikh to come to America. And what'd you say?
What time frame?
1925, 22 or 25, he came here. Way before, just to give you a point of reference, we're going to talk about Rav Moshe Feinstein next week. Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't come until 1936. Most of the great European rabbis, Rav Moshe was even relatively early. Most of them came during World War II or after. So Rav Henkin was like 25 years before these people all came.
How old was he when he came?
He was born in 1881, about in his 40s. Okay, so he had smicha for many great rabbis. His main job was, again, he didn't have a yeshiva. He didn't really have students, and that, when we get to why he sort of he's been forgotten, that will be a piece of it. His main job was, he was the director of an organization called Ezra's Torah. Now, Ezra's Torah, if we were meeting in the chapel, you would know, I could give you a visual. All the shul calendars in America are done by Ezra's Torah. All the rulings there, what to do, are of Henkin's rulings. He was the president, the head of Ezra's Torah. When he died, my Rebbe, Reb David Lifshitz, took that over. And that's sort of part of the reason I got introduced to Rav Henkin. He was a legendary person. He made $50 a week. He never would take a raise. He would walk 3-4 miles every Shabbos to raise money for Ezra's Torah. Just a very special, great person, you know. And again, it's interesting, but there's plenty of people like that. I want to focus on what's unique. I could find other people, but I don't want to not mention it. He had two sons.
You said he raised money on Shabbos?
What'd you say?
You said he walked three...
Yeah, to raise pledges. You could do that. Shuls do that. He didn't take the money, but...
He didn't take cash at Shabbos.
He didn't take cash. He had two sons. One of them I met was Professor Louis Henkin, who passed away, who was the greatest professor of constitutional law in America. You could Google him. He was fully observant. He was Justice Felix Frankfurter's assistant, or whatever the term is. He would sleep in his couch on Shabbos. He would just stay in his office because he wouldn't travel. Observant man. My friend went to Columbia Law, had him. He'd make a mincha minyan. You know, he would pull the students in. He would learn, fully observant, but fully grounded in you know, secular world. And his other son was a rabbi. I don't know much about his other son. But that son's grandson was Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who most of his rulings we know today are through him. You know, we want to know Rav Henkin, we're going to know that through Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the grandson, who's sick. I've met him. He's in Israel. He's been a bit sick, but that's where we know it. So that's all the biographical information. He was the main posek in the United States into the 50s and 60s. Then Rav Moshe Feinstein sort of eclipsed him, and then he passed away in 1973.
And he was widely accepted?
Like, totally widely accepted. So you're going to ask me, why did Rav Moshe surpass him? We're gonna get there. It's a valid point. What were his main tshuvas? Okay, so one, like I said, we know him through Ezra's Torah, the rulings on different things. Also, he was the first rabbi in America. So all the gittin, how do the rabbis know how to write an English name? Right, some guy's got a name, a weird English name. How do you know how to transliterate or transcribe that name? Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin is the authority on any English name because he was the first person here and he dealt with it, and whatever he came up with or said was done. Okay? So that's all the biographical, his profession, his children, who he studied with. Okay, and now let's discuss his main tshuvas. And then the end is really the meat and potatoes, what he represents. And that's my own ideas. So what are some of his main tshuvas? Okay, there's a big argument that came up a few weeks ago about Rosh Hashanah. You have a problem. On one hand, you're not allowed to fast a half a day. So the problem is if shul goes long and you don't eat, you're violating that rule and it's a no-no. On the other hand, there's a problem maybe with eating before hearing the shofar. If you're not Hasidic, there's a problem with that. So this is like a problem what to do. So this shul just tries to get done before Chatzos, the halachic midday, and that's how Young Israel of Hollywood addresses that problem. Other shuls, more yeshivish places, daven longer. That solution won't work. They're not done at one. So they had a practice based on Rav Aaron Cutler that they have a kiddush in the middle. They have kiddush club on Rosh Hashanah. Ironically, the whole year they don't do it. Rosh Hashanah, they take a break. So Rav Henkin did not like that. Rav Henkin felt it was wrong to eat before the first 30 tekiahs because they are from the Torah, they're deraisa. So he said it's better to hear the first 30 blasts than eat, you know, because the other 70, it's a custom. That's one of his famous rulings, so he took on Rav Aaron Cutler. The other thing is, in general, he was a very common sense posek. For example, he had a big problem with commercial merchants selling their chametz, but keeping it in their store. In other words, you have a store, let's say Publix is owned by a Jew, and Publix says, okay, I'm going to sell my chametz, even if they cover it, but it's in the store. To him, that was a sham. It didn't make sense to him. He didn't think that was valid. Rav Moshe did think it was valid, okay? That's another thing. Another example of his common sense approach, civil marriage. Rav Moshe was strict in a way, but very lenient, and we'll discuss it more next week. Rav Moshe allowed, in other words, he would say if someone got married civilly or by Reform rabbi, it's not a valid marriage. Not in a way it's demeaning, but in a way he's doing a great favor, because then when that woman doesn't have a get, which odds are she's not, right? The Reform, or they got married civilly, and she gets remarried, you have a problem with mamzeres, right? Mm-hmm. A child that from illicit union. Rav Henkin did not adhere to that. Rav Henkin said, look, if practically they're living together, because there are opinions in the Rishonim, I don't want to get technical, that if people are living together, we assume they're married, then they're married. And again, this is another example of his very common sense approach to things, like very straight common sense. No, you know, we're not going to reinterpret it to make it work, just straight. Now, a big leniency. Rav Moshe Feinstein was against the concept of an Erev in Manhattan. Okay? To this day, the Lower East Side does not have an Erev. Out of respect to him and his family, they don't have an Erev. It's one of the few places there's no Erev. Rav Henkin felt that definitely there could be an Erev in Manhattan. And probably today, many communities, I know I lived in the West Side, had one, probably they owe that to Rav Henkin. Because there are other great rabbis who allowed it, Rav Menashe Klein, but definitely the weight of his opinion certainly helped with that. So these are examples of some of his main rulings that are known. Now, why am I interested in him, and why do I think he'll become important again? I learned in YU with a Rebbe named Reb David Lifshitz. I was young. I was 17, 18. I don't fully get everything. And then 20, 30 years later, things start making a little sense to you. And I started realizing that the approach that I was taught was not the standard YU approach, nor was it the yeshivish approach. It was something different. I couldn't pin it down when I was 17 or 18. And one of the ways I understand it more is by studying Rav Henkin. Because my Rebbe gave great Gemara Shirim. They published them. Their Shirim are all over the place. You can go to Toras Chaim. You can go to the Lubavitch Beis Medrash. They have them there. They study the Shirim, but he wasn't a posek. He did have psak, but nobody recorded it. So unless you studied with him, you wouldn't really pick up that his approach is different, right? Anyone will know him through the Shirim. They're not going to know that. I believe Rav Henkin represents that approach. And since there's writings, I could rediscover that. What I sort of grasped when I was young, but not fully, I could reconstruct it through Rav Henkin. And I believe he'll be very significant, because I'm going to show you, and this is the bulk of what we're going to discuss, he represents a middle position between yeshivish and modern Orthodox. And I even believe that there are advantages to dealing with modernity with his approach. And I'll explain it now. Let's say modern Orthodox, more modern Orthodoxy in America. It's mainly predicated on Rav Soloveitchik, right? Everybody in this room would agree. There's a problem. Rav Soloveitchik studied with his grandfather. His grandfather was Rav Chaim Brisker. Brisk, if anyone studies it, is anti-modern, right? There's nothing modern about it in terms of the methodology, how they look at halacha. It's anti-modern. So you have this great figure whose Talmudic methodology, his tradition, does not really jive with what he represents. And what I think happens is a lot of his students either freeze what he says. In other words, they're going to say, look, whatever Rav Soloveitchik said, we will accept it. Some of them don't. Some of them roll it back a bit or contextualize it, right? You have some YU Rosh Yeshivas today that say women should learn Gemara. Rav Soloveitchik said they should. Right, they'll come up well, different, but I believe it all stems from one thing, because they don't feel secure. They don't feel like they have a secure tradition. So sometimes, if you have a more traditional approach that's more grounded in a tradition, what's called a Masorah, it may be easier to deal with issues of modernity. It may not have insecurities. It may just be able to deal with it better. And I believe this is a big tension going on today. So how do I see examples of this middle approach? Zionism, okay? So, and also, why is this important? Because we live now in an integrated community here, right? Thank you.
Amen.
We live in a community, Hollywood's changed, that we have yeshivish people here. We interact in Hollywood, and I think it's good, with all types of people. And the truth is, your kids, your sons in Israel, they may go and say, okay, this modern Orthodox thing's lovely, but the vast majority of rabbis and people that are seriously into serious Torah study, guess what they are? Dad, what are they? Yeshivish. So that's what happens to a lot of kids, right? But if we show, okay, there's yeshivish, we're not going to deny that. There's modern, which is a minority, but there's a third approach that is somewhat open to modernity. It's not fully modern. That may sway people's minds how to deal with a lot of these issues, because now it's not this little minority of modern who the leader of Soloveitchik sort of broke with his tradition, right? There's not firm ground there, right? Again, I'm not nothing to detract. He was a great man. He was the only one in his time who could do what he did. In other words, he had to come at that time to fight the conservative movement. No one else could do it. He had a PhD. Rav Henkin did not. He could not, no one else could have been the philosopher of modern Orthodoxy except for Soloveitchik. But I'm arguing in terms of halakha, right, that we may need other tools. So, in other words, your kid comes back to you from Israel and says, Dad, this is nice and dandy what we have here, but the real action, where's the real religious fervor and practice? It's over there. That you could say, son, you make a point, but there's a whole group of people, Rav Henkin represents one of them, that were in the middle. So now it's not a 90-10 argument, it may be more a 60-40 argument. Everybody get that? And that's why I think he's so important. Okay, so let's give some examples where he's smack in the middle.
If Rav Soloveitchik was on our show, you would say that he was a modern Orthodox Jew?
Totally, of the philosophy.
Like, I think if you see him...
What do you mean see him? It's not about how you look, you know?
I think a lot of it is your dress, your...
I don't think that's external. I'm not saying his philosophy. Again, his psak is actually... At times, he was much more strict because of his brisker background than Rav Moshe Feinstein. We're going to discuss that next week. It wasn't consistent. He was the philosopher. Look, he had a PhD in philosophy. There were no other gedolim other than Rav Weinberg in Germany who had a PhD. I can't think of anybody else like that. Maybe Rav Herzog also, right? So let me give you some examples of the middle where he's not modern, he's not yeshivish, Zionism. So he was anti-Zionist before the State of Israel. Okay, vast majority of religious rabbis, Orthodox rabbis were. Once the state was established, he was very angry. He wrote, the people who don't support it or say negative things, it's terrible. Again, he was a pragmatic Zionist. He wasn't a religious Zionist. There are Jews living there. They need to be protected. It's our obligation, he wrote, to donate money, to help, and certainly not to badmouth Israel. So here's a middle position, right? Because you could say, your kid could say, look, this religious Zionist thing, it's a minority thing. It's not authentic. Here's something different that practically Zionist. End of the day, today, he's a Zionist. Right? If Henkin was living here right now, he would tell all of you, support Israel. Give them money. Support them. Help Israel, right? So he's pragmatically a Zionist. Number two, the yeshiva world believes very strongly, if you go to any black hat yeshiva, they learn what's called Nushim and Nezikin, stuff we don't do in our class, okay? They do more abstract Gemara. Why? And I'm not criticizing it, because it's very conceptual. It lends itself to lumdus, which is conceptual thinking, and it is intellectually stimulating, right? They learn Gittin, they learn Kiddushin, they learn about marriage, divorce, they learn about damages, they learn Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. The problem is, and again, I work in a lot of Haredi schools, and they'll say, this is what we have to do. There's a lot of kids, the top kids love it. It's stimulating. It's interesting, but there's a lot of kids, it's over their heads. It's abstract. Why are we studying about cows born cows, right? I get that question all the time, right? Modern schools generally lean towards studying more practical things, like Moed, which is what we study, the laws of Yom Tov, Shabbos, Brachos. YU is a hybrid, actually, right? YU, they do a three-year cycle. They do 1 year Nushim, 1 year Nezikin, 1 year Moed again. But they're dealing with older kids. They're not dealing with 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds. So Rav Henkin very strongly felt that you should not learn, you shouldn't have high school kids learn Nushim and Nezikin, right? He felt very strongly that you first have to master the practical things. He goes, maybe in Eastern Europe, where everyone was so religious and there was so much knowledge just from the street, people knew what to do, that broke down. And if kids don't learn Shabbos, Beitza, which is about Yom Tov, we learned that last year, Moed Katan, right? You know what that is, right? What we're learning this year. If they don't learn these things, they're not going to know what to do. And the best way to know it is through the study of Gemara, right? Because that's the basis of everything. So if you get somebody, a kid smart in a black hat yeshiva, who go up to them, doesn't want to learn this stuff, he'll say, but Rav Henkin also agreed that we don't need to learn this. Because again, somebody thinks, a principal thinks, well, I really think practically 80% of these kids, it's a waste of time when they're 14 to learn. Doesn't relate to them. But how do I take on this tradition? Well, your answer. There are other great rabbis, maybe greater than the rabbis today, who felt differently, that one should learn the practical first. He said once you master that for the top elite, he's talking even after, you know, the beginning of base mentors, then they should learn the other things. But first you must master these things. So that's another example of a middle position, okay? Number three, Heber, right? Today, if you look at the educational lay of the land, you basically have modern Orthodox schools which teach Hebrew as a foreign language, right? That's what their goal is. It's a foreign language. It's not really a religious language. There may be elements of it, but that's not the goal or purpose of the education. And you have yeshivish schools which do not teach any Hebrew, right? Go to Taurus Chaim or whatever, or Mesechina or Lubavitch, they don't open up, they don't do any Hebrew, right? Rav Henkin would be against that. Rav Henkin writes that it's important to learn Hebrew for learning. That's a middle position. Not because it's the modern land of Israel's language, and not to reject it like the yeshivish people do because it's connected to Zionism. But again, here's his pragmatism. To learn, if you know Hebrew, it's much better. So he actually wrote in, if we had time to read all these tshuvas, he wrote, what they should do is teach in English, right? Don't teach in Yiddish or Hebrew at first, but there should be a review class. You teach Gemara. In the review class, teach in Hebrew. Let the kids review and pick up Hebrew. Teach them the basic grammar first. Very pragmatic, very intelligent. I sort of agree with him because the critique on the modern schools, I critique the yeshivish schools with learning Nashim Nezikin, half the kids learning modern Hebrew is a waste of time. Again, for an elite, the top kids, it's great. A lot of kids gain nothing. Maybe if the school's focused on just having their comfort with understanding the text for learning, some kids would go on beyond that and maybe would learn modern Hebrew. Some wouldn't. But how many people practically use modern Hebrew, right? So at the end of the day, we invest 12, 13 years of our kids learning it. How much do they really use it? So his approach would be, let's make it a learning language. You know, let's have this. And again, in today's times, most of the great yeshivas on Israel are learning in Hebrew, whether they're Haredi or modern. So if your child had that ability to follow a shiur in Hebrew, that's very significant. That would fit with his vision. Middle position. Feminism, we're going to do the tshuva. So again, maybe some modern-minded poskim would embrace feminism. He does not embrace it, but yet he doesn't run from it either. He says we must follow halacha. He will not bend halacha, but he realizes this could be a powerful force to motivate women to be more religious. There's a tshuva about saying Kaddish. Actually, I don't know if I'm going to read it. It's the back. And he says that. We should let women say Kaddish. And again, you have to put him in the context. This isn't 2019. He probably wrote this in the 40s or 50s. It's a different world. But he had the vision to say, you know what? You know, this is a way to bring people in. This is a way to connect them to Judaism. If it isn't a halakhic issue, in other words, his job is to rule out that there's a halakhic problem. He's not going to bend the halakha. It's a change in practice, so be it. Let women say Kaddish. You know, he's very clear. If it's only some shuls have a custom where only one person says it, he goes, in that case, they should not do it. But if it's a shul like ours where multiple people say Kaddish, let them say Kaddish. So, again, very forward thinking. It doesn't sound forward thinking to you because you're living in the world after he said it, but put it in the context.
But how much do you think maybe he's responding to the people of America? In other words, they were Zionists, right?
Right.
They were supporting the state. I would think, on balance, the American Jewry,
right?
Right. They were also feminists, and they weren't going to let that train.
Right. So he doesn't embrace. What makes him not modern, in my opinion, he doesn't embrace these things, but he's pragmatic to work with it. And what's the advantage? Now, you may not intellectually, you may say, Jonathan, that doesn't appeal to me. The more modern-minded rabbis sound better. Like, if we read the Sridayashis Tshuva about Bas Mitzvah, he embraces it. Now, you may say, man, that appeals to me more. The problem is, and again, this is my own idea, what's going to stick long-term? When your kid comes back from Israel, more religious, or your kid, and you have to show him, well, if you quote the Sridayashis, she'll say, that's nice and dandy, but that's not traditional. So if we can get to the same place with a more traditional approach, I believe it will stand the test of time, it'll be more secure, and it actually, long-term, may work better. That's what I think. That's just my opinion. So he worked with these things. He saw, he didn't run from them. He didn't badmouth it, but he didn't embrace it. So it's a very pragmatic approach. So those were the main points. We'll read his tshuva. We'll end with that tshuva, because maybe we'll read Rav Moshe's tshuva and you'll see the nuance. Even though the rulings are 100% the same, the attitudes are very different. Okay, so I want to also point out, any questions so far? No. I want to point out just a side point.
Where did he live?
He lived in the Lower East Side, near Rav Moshe, not far from there. Anytime you see a posek, you see rulings, or you hear rulings, you should always ask yourself, what is their primary focus? What are they drawn by? In other words, some poskim are into textual truth, which means the main thing is the text, is the reading of the text proper. I don't care what the minug is. I don't care what the lumbus is. I could care less what Kabbalah says. What I care is, does that reading of the text make sense? Who espouses that? The Vilna Gaon, the Chazon Ish. Okay? Then there are those who espouse the conceptual truth. I don't care how the text is read. I don't care what the practice is. I could give a hoot less what Kabbalah says. Does it conceptually make sense? Who represents that? The Briskers. People like Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather. That's how they look at halacha, right? Then there are those like Rav Henkin and Rav Moshe. Again, there'll be differences. That look at things by more the practice of the people. That's more important. In other words, even if the textual reading isn't perfect, if we can find a way to justify it within bounds, I mean, there's going to be limits, we're going to go with that. That's also the Aruch HaShulchan, who Rav Henkin, there's a debate, he may have gotten smicha from him, and felt that that was more authoritative than the Mishnah Berurah. Okay? So that's another approach. So that's where he falls. Okay, then there's another school of thought. We'll call it Choshesh L'Chol HaDeos, which in Hebrew means we're going to be suspectful for all or majority of the opinions. In other words, textual truth isn't important. Conceptual truth isn't important. The practice isn't important. We're going to count up seven achronim, have an argument, and five of them say X, two of them say the other thing. We're going to worry about the five, even if the other data goes the other way, right? Or we may even care about all seven and be stricter where we can. That's more like the Mishnah Berurah, right?
When Rob Henkin was here early, you said he came here
way before anyone else, yeah.
Didn't he establish some precedence, and so like Rob Moshe came 15 years later, should have show some deference to Rob
No.
Henkin's opinions?
Why not? Why? Because New York's a, I don't know if you've ever been to New York, it's a very big city.
You said they were both in the Lower East Side near each other.
Yeah, but these were, these they were not the chiefs of little fiefdoms. These were the biggest postkim in the world. They were for all of America. You know, they're allowed to argue. Why? They're both great rabbis. I'm saying there's no issue with Rav Moshe arguing with them. I'm saying they're both great. These were the two greatest postkim who ever lived in America and probably ever will live in America. You know? Would it be an issue? Was it like everything was established? Well, certain things like the names with Get and Gittin, yes, nobody ever questions that. Or the Ezra Torah Luach. You know, those things stuck. We'll see. Rav Moshe was different. Rav Moshe is not going to be like this, you know? Open-minded, but more yeshivish. It's not this third approach.
When Rav Soloveitchik came along, did his Talmidim and like the modern Orthodox world defer to the Tshuvos of Rav Moshe Feinstein?
Very often he sent them to Rav Moshe. We'll talk about that next week more. Because again, it was easier almost for him. For Soloveitchik was very strict on a lot of things. It was better for him to send you to his cousin, who was more lenient. So, yes, he often sent people. And we'll see next week that Rav Moshe had strong ties to Yeshiva University in that world.
And was there an overlap with Rav Pinkin?
With who?
With Rav Soloveitchik, that he could have sent these questions?
I don't think as much. I don't think he wasn't his cousin. He respected him. He said many favorable things, but everyone respected him. There's not anyone in the world that would have a bad word to say about Rav Henkin, or, you know, they may disagree with rulings, but nobody would question his piety or his knowledge or his sitkis. I mean, he was a very special person.
Did Rav Moshe ever talk in person?
Oh, I think so, yes. They lived near each other.
Right.
They were neighbors, you know, within a few blocks. If you know the neighborhood, it's not a big neighborhood.
Right.
You know, the yeshiva of Moshe's yeshiva is actually...
They weren't the same age, though, right?
No, Rav Henkin was older. But Rav Moshe's yeshiva is actually technically out. It's in Chinatown. So the neighborhood's really small, Lower East Side. They got good pickles there.
So Rav Henkin learned under Rav Cutler's father-in-law?
Yes, and so did Rav Moshe Feinstein. They both learned with him, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. But he was nothing like Rav Aaron Cutler. Actually, he's made statements. They said, my son-in-law is going to be a fanatic that's going to change the world. And he was right, you know. Nothing like him. What?
In a good way or a bad way?
A descriptive way. He was not the same. What else did I want to say before we read the tshuva? So, why was he surpassed by Rav Moshe? One, like I mentioned, he didn't have a yeshiva. He didn't really have students. His grandson was his main student, who actually moved to Israel, and probably a lot of these rulings are more known there than here. A few other people, I think Rav Nachum Rabinovich studied with him. Here and there were people, but no yeshiva, no way to give over the information like that. Number two, he wrote less. Okay, and that could be, this is my own thought, because of the times he was in, he may have not felt that these tshuvas were for posterity. When Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote those tshuvas, those 6-7 volumes, there's a debate whether he wrote the 7th volume, were for posterity. Rav Henkin, because he was operating in a different world, he was dealing with different problems. It could be he didn't feel that. Although that's not true, they are for posterity. So he didn't write as much, he didn't have students. Therefore, and again, maybe what I like about him was a weakness. He wasn't associated with an ideological camp. In other words, if Soloveitchik gets up at the Mizrahi convention, there's thousands of people, hundreds of people listening to him. He has a big platform. Rav Moshe Feinstein gets up at the Aguda convention, same thing. He was not part of any organization. Henkin was not affiliated with either Mizrahi or Aguda, or the RCA, or any of these organizations. So he had what I see as a strength, maybe a weakness.
But they all followed his calendar?
This calendar, right? You guys follow his calendar.
Everyone gets it.
The Ezra Star calendar. Yeah, that and the Gittin now stuck. Okay, so that's why. So let's look at his tshuva a little bit, and then we'll call it a day. Any other questions?
What about Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky?
He was a very great rabbi, not so much a posek. He was more Rosh Hashiva. Moderate Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva. Had the equivalent of a high school education. Very great man. I mean, you have a specific question?
No, I'm friends with the grandson, but I just...
Right, very special, you know, person, very moderate. His son married Reb David Lifshitz's daughter, Reb Nosson Kamenetsky, who just passed away. I was actually supposed to meet him in Israel. Unfortunately, he, you know, passed away. Rav Yaakov is probably similar to Rav Moshe Feinstein. If I had a moderate, a good, a not, third way.
What made him a post? I mean, who wrote him questions?
Who, Rav Hengen?
Yeah, people didn't really know about him.
I mean, no. The shul rabbis of the 1930s and 40s knew about him. I mean, they wrote him. There's all these questions people wrote him. He was known to these. We don't today know about him. People back then knew about him. You know? But I think this 15, idea...
15, 20 years before all the other rabbis from Europe came.
And he was the great, biggest rabbi. There was nobody else to ask. It's not like today you can...
Was he someone in Europe, or he was too young?
No, he was a great rabbi. He was great, known as a great rabbi in Europe, too. So that's the story. So we'll look at this tshuva a little bit, and then we'll... Any other questions? But what I mainly wanted to get across, one, is share with you about this great person, so his legacy's not lost. Two, this third way thing, it's my own idea, but the older I get, I think there's a lot of common sense to it, because I think that will help with dealing with modernity. It will help, you know, like I said, a lot of kids go to Israel, they don't believe in the modern Orthodox philosophy, but if they see, well, many issues, he aligns people like this, and he's one representative. There's many more people, but he's a posek, so we have his tshuvas. That changes the equation. All right, let's look at this a little bit. Again, so two things I want to look at with this tshuva. One, again, we're living in a world where every girl celebrates a bas mitzvah, so we have to roll the clock back. We have to roll the clock back and realize that the bas mitzvahs were coming from reform and conservative. So let's make you Rav Hengen, right? It's in the 1940s or 50s. You're a rabbi. There are rabbis writing to you from other communities, from Hollywood, Florida, and their congregants want a bas mitzvah. Their cousin down the street who goes to Temple Solel gets one, and this girl really wants to have one. And the rabbi's going to write you about it. This is what, I'm giving you the context, because for us to read this without understanding that is meaningless, because every girl in our shul gets some, you know, type of bas mitzvah. Okay, so again, that's one, I want to focus on that. And two, I want you to store what we say here, because I want to contrast it with Rav Moshe Feinstein next week. Okay, so the first paragraph is about something else, and often in tshuvas, you know, they would write one letter, the rabbi may have had a few questions. That's not relevant to us, so we don't really care about that. Let's skip to the second. We're going to read that. Okay. V'od v'inyin bas mitzvah liyiladis, a bas mitzvah to a girl. Hine eklal shamru. There's a principle, shlilash, that yell at him, yimayim, srachim, we don't throw a child away. Bavadai, now he's making a proviso. Before he's permitting it, he's setting out the parameters of it, right? Bavadai, ein lekrat Torah, don't read. The girl shouldn't get an aliyah. Lo, la bas mitzvah, lo l'shamisha cheres, not even for her mommy or anyone else. Vein ma lepapa bazen, don't go there, basically. Vavilu lasos technica cheres ein lasos sebes shabbos. Now this is interesting. This has nothing to do with a bas mitzvah. This is historical context. Rav Moshe says the same thing. He doesn't want them doing anything on Shabbos, but it doesn't matter if it would be a boy or girl. Why? Ki gorim chil Shabbos. Because remember, a lot of people weren't observant. If you made a bar mitzvah here, or a bat mitzvah, in the 19, you know, thank God today it's different. In the 1950s, 80% of the participants, rest assured, took the subway if they were in the Lower East Side, or drove there if they were here. So he doesn't like it. Nothing to do with girls, just, it's just going to lead to Chilul Shabbos. All right, we actually could skip the rest of this, because he's just showing that the Chazal make zeirus about shaking lulav. They prevented mitzvahs so people wouldn't be machal. Same thing here, right? We don't really need to read that. That's just an interesting story. Okay, let's read this. Vumdom. However, chovaseinu, it's our obligation, he, lechanokas abanos aderech haTorah, to educate our daughters in the path of Torah, ulahatzil, this is very interesting, and to save masha efshel lahatzil, what is possible to save. Remember, he's dealing with a tide of assimilation. Many people are leaving observance. It's not like today where the Orthodox community is growing. In his time, it was a checkout, not a check-in. Now he shows historical precedence for this. Poland, and that the rabbis in Poland did, that they made girls' schools. Now again, huge innovation. No religious girls got education before the 1900s. It was not considered proper. They would learn at home. They didn't learn. They learned to bake kugel, whatever they did. They didn't go to school. It was a radical innovation to say that there should be girls' schools. So what Henkin here is doing is he's saying bas mitzvah fits in. In other words, Rav Henkin thinks historically there was an innovation in the 1900s that worked out pretty well. We may need another innovation in the 1950s, right? So that's what he's saying. Shutova rabba liyadasham, that it was a great benefit for Judaism, the Gabkan, and it was a benefit in Poland and in America. Avalo at a kol halechas lebeis Yaakov. So you could counter him and say, Rabbi, great, we have Beis Yaakov. What do we need a bas mitzvah for? So he's answering that. But not everybody goes to Beis Yaakov. Kamoshalo, kol holkam yeshiva. Not every Jew goes to yeshiva. Right? So Rav Henkin was cognizant. You always have to ask yourself, when these poskim may have a psak, who is their audience? His audience just isn't. And this is going to be very important for Moshe also. His audience isn't just very religious people. He's thinking about all Jews, even those nominally affiliated. You know, probably affiliated with Orthodoxy, but very nominally. Right? Okay. V'yasod chadari lamed banos levadzan. They should learn. V'zet niyotz kavir l'neshamen. This is like a spark for the breath of their soul. And this bas mitzvah, they should learn about mitzvahs, the chizik adas, and strengthening their religious foundations. Not just Hebrew. Bas mitzvah, and if this ceremony can bring them closer to Torah study, we certainly should strengthen it. Right? That's all we really need to read. But his attitude's pretty favorable, right? Again, he's not embracing it for modernity's sake. He's not saying, well, boys and girls are equal, we should give them the same. He's practical. He's like, look, it's hard, it's a struggle to be religious. If this is one, you know, tool in the toolbox to bring people in, and there's no halakhic issue, he, you know, set out the parameters that can't be aliyahs. He doesn't want it on Shabbos. That today, in our community, he wouldn't have an issue with, because the people are largely observant. But he's saying, he's looking at it very practically. When we look at Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe will permit it, but he doesn't have a favorable attitude to it. So again, this is a middle approach. It's not the Rav Weinberg. It's not Rav Moshe. It's something else. So are there any other questions?
Is Weinberg the one from Aish?
No, it's a different Rav Weinberg from, he lived in Eastern Europe and Germany and Switzerland. So, I don't know, does anyone else have any questions?
Just a comment, I guess. I think that your idea that he's more palatable for these kids coming from unorthodoxy but are going to be scared that they're a minority because everyone's so from, it's a very new phenomenon. There's no reason to believe it's going to last.
Why? I'm not saying you're wrong or right, just why do you think that?
I mean, it's like Jordache jeans. What do you mean? It's pretty popular.
The whole idea that everyone's so sheepish. No, but
listen, Rabbi Freiberg. Rabbi Freiberg, look, practically, I talk to kids.
No one went to yeshiva 30 years ago.
Right, that's why I said keep going. Right.
But for today, it would be relevant.
It's already stopped.
But Rabbi Freiberg, you could, listen, you get a kid here, goes to Israel, comes back, seeks you out. And he's struggling
with. It's sure true, but I think in a historical timeline, it's very myopic. Meaning, like.
Yeah, but then for right now, it's relevant.
For right now, but first of all, I don't believe that. Many people have argued it's not sustainable and it will change. It's already changed. I mean, 30 years ago, it was. If you went to Kola, you were crazy. Now, if you don't go to Kola, you're crazy. Right? There's no reason to believe it's going to stay the way. A, it's financially unfeasible. And B, this, none of these guys are happy. Not true. People are going to work. These schools for Haredim to get jobs and education in Israel are growing by the day.
Yeah, but it's a minuscule percentage. Yeah, I think it's minuscule. It's a drop in the bucket.
I think it's growing. It's not
but in America, look, we have kids in our community. They come back and you see them.
For sure, but I think the second point is telling them, well, you don't want to hang your hat on Rav Soloveitchik because he's the minority, but you feel overwhelmed by his sheevish. What about Rav Henkin? He's more minority than...
No, but you're adding him to Rav Soloveitchik and others. And again, Rav Henkin is a representative.
If you're in that mindset of, like, numbers are power...
Right, he doesn't have the...
Rav Henkin is no one. Right. I mean, not that he's no one, no one's
right.
Heard of him.
Right.
So I don't think that's...
No, but it's another thing. In other words, but you could go, you can argue with a black hat person, say, listen, I just gave you guys... five or six issues where he differs with the yeshiva world.
Yeah, but you're talking in such a sociological context that, like, he's not a player in that. Not that he shouldn't be, he's just
right.
Not.
But he's not a player, but let's make him a player.
Yeah, but the whole point of this, the whole argument is, like, you want to do what everyone else is doing. So at least they know we're a Salvation minority. They never heard of Rankin before, so...
Yeah, but if we're showing them a world where we... I saw this world a bit when I was young, right?
Saying,
you guys didn't see this world. I'm trying to
be so intellectual about it. You don't have this problem in the first place.
What'd you say?
If you're going to be so intellectual about it, you don't have this problem in the first place. You'll be like, yeah.
But wait, there's two things I said. Yeah. I hear your point. But what about the Rav Soloveitchik doesn't stand on firm ground because his tradition, there's two different points I said. That's one thing. The problem, even a lot of his students are much more to the right of him, right?
Cool.
Because the ground is not firm. He's a Brisker. His grandfather was not anything but pro-modern, right? So what grounds? Some will argue, Rav his nephew, Rav Meiselman, says that Rav Soloveitchik did all these innovations
right.
For Kirov.
He's an outlier.
Well, not such an outlier. Not, I could give you many of them. Okay, it's degrees.
Of the students, he's the outlier.
He's the most extreme outlier. But there's gradations.
Right.
But again, even today, the present YU Rosh Yeshivas are rolling back, like I mentioned, with the Gemara. Rav Willicks' girl should not learn Gemara today. He's rolling back. If it was based more on something that was a continuity of tradition, it's much harder to roll back. That's what I'm arguing. There's less security. There's a big insecurity I see.
I don't think Rav Henkin's going to give anyone security. This is really also sociological. It's nothing to do with him, or it's true, but I just don't believe that he's going to fill that role. Because he didn't. So to now make...
But people discover new things. Yeah. Look, what's neo-Hasidus? Nobody in this building or in YU cared about Hasidus 20, 30 years ago. Right. I went there, they would laugh at it. Now kids find meaning in it. If they found that... they could find this. They could find anything. I'm just bringing out something in the tradition that I was sort of exposed to that people don't know about. You know, that's what I'm here to do. I'm saying, it's a tool. And again, I'm not negating Rav Soloveitchik. Probably all the tools are good, but this is another tool. You know, it changes the equation a bit. Because, again, there's more security. When you deal with things practically, it's harder to knock it off as versus when you embrace the modernity. It's like, I'll give you a great example. There's a big moral problem. You're not allowed to give gifts to non-Jews, technically, right? So there's different ways to deal with that, or even give them compliments. So that doesn't sit well with anyone in this room, I think, right? It doesn't sit well with you. I didn't think so. All right? So the modern approach would be to follow the Meiri. What does the Meiri say? Well, that's only talking, that prohibition is talking about the seven nations. They don't exist today. Hence, none of these prohibitions apply. Hence, you could go and compliment non-Jews from today till tomorrow. Now, morally, it appeals to me. It's great. The problem is, if you study enough, and I don't know what you feel, the Meiri is a minority position. And not only that, he was only discovered, they lost his writings in the 1900s. So I like it morally, but the pragmatic approach would be, well, we can't have animosity. You chisel away at the prohibition versus taking it on head on. And that approach, while it's not morally satisfying, it will last the test of time. The Meiri, some kid will go to Israel, flip out. This is nonsense. I heard in the shul, we follow the Meiri, the rabbi got up there. It's nonsense. 30 other Rishonim disagree. The other approach, the kid can't say it's nonsense. Great Poskim said it. That's my argument. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't think the kid flipping out is going to last the test of time.
That may or may not be. And I'm not going to last the test of time.
It doesn't worry.
But I'm saying that's... Same thing with Bas Mitzvah, right? It's morally better to take the modern. I'm morally drawn to it. But I don't think it's going to work for a lot of people. So a lot of times to deal with these issues, you chip away, you deal with it pragmatically, like Rav Henkin did. It will last longer. It's more secure. It's more firmly rooted. You can't question it as much.
I mean, I'm just not as clear because I have a very myopic view. You know, I grew up in
Sotmer.
I grew up in KJ in the modern Orthodox world, right? So,
right.
But who's asking him these? Where were these shilas coming from? What was
all over the country?
I understand that, but what were the communities like? Weren't they like that, sort of just to the right of conservatives?
Yes, yes, and that's why. By the way, he has a tshuva. Forgive me for quoting it. He allows you to daven in a shul without a makitza. That's going to blow your mind. Now, let me give you the context so you don't all run out of here and go to Temple Sinai tomorrow. What?
If there's no alternative.
So let me give you the context. And it shows you what a broad-minded person he was, and it gives you the context. This is the case. Jonathan Hirsch lives a mile north of Oak Ridge. Now, Oak Ridge is a long walk to here, right? 2 miles is not doable this time of year. Now, the choice is going to a shul that's halachic but doesn't have a pizza, right? And maybe Jonathan can influence them, or not going to shul. He says in that case, one has to weigh what they should do. Now, we're used to pat answers. They don't have a mechitza, don't go there. He doesn't think like that. Now, what's behind that? And we'll get to this next week. Mechitza is important, but there's a range of opinions. Rav Moshe will tell you it's an Isser D'Oraisa. Rav Soloveitchik will tell you it's an Isser D'Rabbanan. There were poskim who said it's a minhag. Now, it's important. He would definitely tell you don't set up a shul without it. But in the case where you have no other option, he would say maybe if you could influence those people. He was dealing with a lot of non-religious people. And he wanted to influence them. He didn't want to run from them. Some poskim want to speak, like the Chazon Ish. There's a great book about him in Hebrew. He was speaking to the elite. We're going to see with Rav Moshe the beauty of him, why he was so great. He spoke to two audiences. every tshuva I'm going to show you next week is two-tiered. Two-tiered anything with modernity. Two audiences. The Chazon Ish was only speaking to super religious people. He had nothing to say to us, really. I mean, to people like us or less religious than us. Rav Henkin was speaking to people much less religious. So he was doing anything to keep them in the fold.
So the communities that were, let's say, in Baltimore or...
The whole country.
Well, but the more religious, already religious established communities were probably not even asking him.
Probably not as much, but they still respected him. But he was that was most of, when you say very religious. In 1930, there weren't very many very religious people.
There weren't.
Now, it's not like here today. This is, they would look at this like, whoa. You know, they would never, there were very few Shomer Shabbos people. So it was very different. So he's very, I mean, I think he's very open-minded. I mean, that tshuva today would blow people's minds, but he said it. It's written in here.
Who does Rabbi Victor Miller fit?
What?
Rabbi Victor Miller.
I don't think he compares with Rav Henkin. I mean,
he's a black hatter.
Total black hatter, yeah. Hardcore black hatter. With a little science background, I think. But yeah, he's pretty. I'm not so familiar, but he's not. He's not in the same level as the people we're studying the next 3 weeks. Not even close. Any other questions? Okay. Something different, I hope, right?
I remember we just took you for